You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. until 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to 3CR Breakfast on Tuesday, the 19th of May, 2026. And thank you to the Radioactive Show, 3CR's national program on nuclear peace and energy issues. My name's Fung, and in the studio, we've got Fiza and Julia. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
We've all got our... No, I shouldn't say we. You both have your cozy winter jumpers on.
Serious jumpers, yes.
Serious jumpers. I'm really liking your... The colour on your jumper.
Thank you.
How would you describe the shades of blue and green for those who can't be with us in the studio?
Maybe like it's like a sky blue.
Yes.
Maybe a sky blue. And then we got a little baby pink.
Yes. Oh, it's
and
pink.
Then, yeah, the stripe. Yeah.
And then, I don't know, this is like almost grass green.
Yes.
It is very grass green. Yeah. I love that.
Love that.
Thanks.
Yeah. Yeah. So love a bit of colour when it's... So grey and gloomy.
Exactly. Mm. Yeah. Thanks.
Yes, it is. Although it's not like freezing.
No.
It was actually quite lovely last night. Yeah, I had after work dinner and then we were walking back and we all kept commenting as usual. But oh, how lovely this weather is. It's just like, it's always such a surprise when the weather's actually nice in Melbourne, I think. And it's like, oh, look at this.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's not miserable. What a surprise.
Yeah. Yeah.
True.
Okay, well, before we delve into what we have coming up on today's show, just wanted to alert our listeners that Radiothon is just around the corner. It's happening in June.
So fast.
And we are already halfway through May.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
What? Okay.
So Radiothon is coming, as you all know. Each year during Radiothon, we try to raise a certain amount to keep this community radio station running because it's pretty
community
much
run.
Yeah, it's community run. It's all volunteers.
Yep.
And we get to talk about what we want to talk about and broadcast news that doesn't really get spoken about anywhere else.
Yeah. I think that's a big push for pivoting from mainstream media at the moment. And I think community radio is definitely one of those spaces that people should invest into in exchange for divesting from mainstream media.
Exactly. Yeah. Even just like instead of listening to Spotify, sometimes I'll just put on like the radio on my phone if I'm doing, especially doing something kind of mindless and listen to that instead. I don't know. I just, like, of course, there's nothing wrong with listening to whatever you like.
No,
but
yeah.
It's just something different.
Exactly. And you never know. Exactly.
Yeah.
And also, as an 80s baby, I highly recommend listening to radio because then you actually hear songs you don't expect to hear, which is kind of a thing that happened in the past where you couldn't choose. There were no playlists.
Yeah.
You just put up with whatever the radio throws at you, and it was great. And that's how you discovered new bands, and that's how you discovered new music. So
Exactly. And I don't know if either of you saw this. It was published yesterday, but Beat Magazine published a post saying that a new report shows community radio generates $153 million for the Australian music scene.
Woo-hoo.
So, there's that. And just quickly, a shout out to Triple R, another independent community radio station, because they, yesterday, the 18th of May, marked their 50 years since they were granted a broadcast license.
Amazing.
So there's that. But for our Radiothon that's coming up in June, we're celebrating 50 years, which is very exciting.
Very exciting.
And our target is $300,000 as a station. So if you can give any amount and no donation is too small or big, then please
Yeah, and we will have a radiothon show in June.
Yes, yes, we will release more details when we have them.
So we'll cover that. Excited. Exactly.
Yeah. But if there are any regular listeners out there who want to chat to us on air during radiothon,
please
get in touch.
Yeah, please get in touch. I don't know who. Are you listening? Is anybody out there?
Surely, how could they?
Somebody's awake at seven, for the love of God.
How could they miss our banter about the weather and jumpers every week? But yeah, okay, so to talk about what's happening on today's show, up first we'll be replaying a segment from Radio Philef during their International Women's Day episode. The clip features a roundtable discussion between several members of Philef, which is an Italian migrant workers and families organization, and they discuss Italian International Women's Day demonstrations. And then at 7:30, we'll be joined by Lucinda Thorpe, privacy campaigner from Digital Rights Watch. She recently wrote an article about the ways in which dating platforms are collecting and monetizing people's personal and biometric data. So we'll be discussing that, as well as the way that AI has infiltrated the technology.
At 7:45, we'll be speaking with Freya Leonard, who is a climate campaigner for the Australian Conservation Foundation. And she'll be speaking with us about the recent federal budget release, specifically discussing the lack of tax on gas exports.
And at 8 o'clock, we'll be joined by Victoria, an Australian-born Thai Burmese lawyer and event organiser for the Hearts for Burma fundraiser that will be happening at Bar Flippies this Friday.
And finally, at 8:15, we'll be replaying a segment from Tuesday Home Time from last Tuesday, the 12th of May, where Jan Butler spoke with humanitarian photojournalist Liz Lowe Taylor about her time at a Western Sahara refugee camp in Algeria, as well as talking about justice for the Sahrawi people. So that's what's coming up on today's show. We'll be back with the news headlines in just a moment.
Some folks know about it, some don't.
You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast, and these are the news headlines for Tuesday, the 19th of May, 2026. Last week marked the Nakba, the catastrophe of 1948, that saw more than 750,000 Palestinians forcibly displaced from their homes and lands. But as Australia-Palestine Advocacy Network's new campaign makes clear, the Nakba is not just history. It continues today through siege, annexation, settlement expansion, and mass displacement across Gaza and the West Bank. As communities and MPs mark Nakba Day throughout the week, APAN is urging Australians to get behind the growing campaign, calling on the federal government to divest from the Future Fund from companies linked to Israeli weapons, occupation and illegal settlements. Supporters are encouraged to attend local events, share campaign materials and help build pressure for Australia to end its financial complicity.
Just a trigger warning, the following headline contains mention of suicide. If you need support after hearing this, please call 13YARN on 139276 or Lifeline on 13 11 14. The Indonesian Parliament has passed new legislation to protect the rights of domestic workers as formal workers. The passing of the law is the first step. It's the first step to protecting workers. The government now has 1 year to prepare regulations and establish protection standards. This monumental decision came 1 day after the tragic death of one underage domestic worker and the critical injury of another worker who were trying to escape exploitative working conditions. Domestic workers in Indonesia number 4.2 million, 90% of whom are women. Estimates from 2012 suggest that 700,000 of these workers are under the age of 18. The new legislation comes after 2 decades of advocacy and will ensure regulation of workers' conditions, provide access to vocational training, health insurance and leave, as well as mandating a minimum age of 18 for domestic work. Lita Angriani, National Coordinator at advocacy organisation Jala PRT, commented on the win. The most important thing now is recognition of working hours, religious holiday allowances, wages, days off, accommodation and food, as well as social security and social assistance, all of which have been missing and have kept domestic workers in poverty. Also in the news, new research from Amnesty International Australia has found that Australian company Ioneer is involved in the construction of lithium mines in Nevada, which breach international human rights standards. The Rhyolite Ridge Lithium Project is one of a number of mining projects across Nevada, moving ahead without the free, prior and informed consent of Indigenous peoples, and threatens their health, environment and culture. Nevada has become a focal point of lithium extraction in the United States, known to hold 85% of American lithium reserves. Shelley Harjo, member of the Fort McDermitt, Paiute and Shoshone tribe, spoke about one of the projects. "The mine is going to destroy our homelands, our way of living," Harjo continued. "There was never any genuine consent given by the community. Our tribe is financially impoverished. I feel like we are taken advantage of, our being so naive to what is really happening at the time."
Listeners are warned that the following headline mentions the death of Indigenous persons as well as content that may be distressing to listeners. Aboriginal leaders say the Northern Territory government's inquiry into child safety will not allow for a proper examination of the system, leaving out Indigenous representation and voices. The CLP government announced an investigation into the NT's child protection system in the lead-up to the death of Kumanjayi Little Baby. Earlier this month, NT Child Protection Minister Robin Cahill said three child protection workers had been stood down after concerns were raised about circumstances in the weeks leading up to Kumanjayi Little Baby's disappearance and death. Catherine Little, CEO of National Voice for Our Children, says that changes to the child protection system in the NT are urgently needed, with advocates, community-led organisations, multiple reports and people with lived experience of the territory's system calling for action and investment for decades. Ms. Little also expressed alarm that the scope of the inquiry will not examine the leaking of private and confidential information related to Kumanjayi Little Baby and her family. "The leaking of this information is incredibly serious and has the potential to place families, particularly those fleeing domestic and family violence, at further risk of harm," she said. These have been the news headlines for Tuesday, 19th of May, 2026. You're listening to 3CR Breakfast on 855 AM.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings. Cards that connect, care and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from so-called Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalization intersect where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM, or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, where about?
Feminisms in their multitudes.
First Nations sovereignty.
Land back.
Trans liberation. Poo-poo on the turfs.
Abolition.
Anti-racism.
Sex worker rights.
South liberation.
Disability justice.
Anti-imperialism.
Decolonisation.
An end to borders.
Workers' justice.
And so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986. Woo! Woo! Woo!
You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast on 855 AM 3CR Digital and online at 3cr.org.au. And before we go into our next segment, we just want to say that we received the nicest text message this morning. So shout out to Sally. Thank you so much for listening to our show. And in the message, Sally says that I use the community radio app. So yes, if you don't have it, you can download it on your smartphone and listen to all of the 3CR shows on the go.
Definitely.
Or from the couch, from the bed, wherever.
Anywhere. On your headphones.
So just wanted to take this opportunity, I guess, to let you know that if you are listening and you feel like sending us a text message, you can. Mm-hmm. The number is 0488 809 855.
Yes, so we are very open to feedback. Maybe less weather banter. I feel like that's coming.
Give us some ideas for pre-show chat. Anyway, thank you Sally. Yes. Okay, so first up this morning, we are going to listen to a recording from Radio Philef's International Women's Day episode this year. The clip features a roundtable discussion between Hannah, Margherita, Renata and Loretta, who are members of Philef, which is the Italian Migrant Workers and the Families Organization. In this clip, they discuss Italian International Women's Day demonstrations, analyse how Italian demonstration culture contrasts with those here in so-called Australia.
I'm here with Renata, Lorella, Margherita. Buonasera.
Buonasera.
Come state?
Buonasera.
Buonasera, Hannah.
It's been a pretty big weekend of events for International Women's Day, which was last Sunday, the 8th of March. We were talking before about different events that were on this weekend here in Australia and in Italy and also all around the world. Here, we were mentioning before that here compared to Europe and South America, Latin America, the rallies and the marches aren't as big. So to go off the events that happened, I was at an event on Sunday that was run by 18 different Greek and Cypriot organizations, which was pretty cool. They had some great key speakers who spoke about the silence of women and in our cultures, like Greek, Cypriot, Italian cultures, staying silent is sometimes seen as a strength, and how it's not a strength, it's kind of a survival technique. And so these women got up and talked from personal experience about culture and tradition having a part to play in a lot of what women struggle and suffer as well. And it was really special to see so many different intergenerational women come together for this event. Aside from that, I'm going to pass to Margherita to tell us about some stuff that happened in Italy across the weekend.
Thank you, Hannah. Silence is definitely not a strength. I think, as you were saying, in Italy and across Europe, the demonstrations for International Women's Day are really, really big. This year, again, women went down in some piazze in over 60 cities in Italy. There were massive demonstrations across the country. So thousands and thousands have marched. It's something that I used to participate a lot in Italy, especially when I used to live in Rome. And it's something that I really miss here, because as you're saying, there's not really big marches in Australia and in Melbourne where we are. Another important thing, I guess, to mention is that the demonstrations in Italy are transfeminist, una manifestazione transfemminista. So very, very intersectional. And people went down on the streets, women and allies, and everyone who just identifies as a woman, also against all wars, against the patriarchy and capitalism. And I think that's really important. Mm-hmm. And then on Monday the 9th, there always is a very big strike against all productive and also reproductive labor, mm-hmm. because we need to remember the reproductive labor is also labor and fundamento del capitalismo, anche quello.
I think historically it's a really interesting question. Why? Because
in the past, there have also been tensions within the women's movement here in Australia about women speaking for women in the sense of Indigenous women and migrant women possibly being invited as a speaker but not being involved from the beginning about, well, what will the day look like? What are the priorities going to be? How will we have this day? All that sort of...
Well, I have to... The committee that put it together was an open committee, and so everyone was invited.
Yeah, everyone's invited.
But no, it wasn't... I mean, at the time when we were doing it, not Trades Hall, so I can't talk for what Trades Hall did. Sure. But in fact, we wanted people to be there to help plan and to work out, and so we invited people. But you're right, there was certainly a lot of difficulty, and I know in the last few years that I was involved, we had great difficulty with groups so-called TERFs and SWERFs, so trans-exclusionary and sex worker-exclusionary feminist groups, so-called. And they would make it very, very difficult for trans women who came or sex workers who came and identified, to the point that these women felt unsafe, which was appalling. So I agree that there were certainly, and it's really hard to ask people to be involved in the whole process, then at the end to feel unsafe. So yes, Lorella, you're right.
It's interesting here because maybe it's to do with our political history of Australia as well, because when you see Italy at the moment with all the manifestazioni that they've organized and the amount of different groups they've been able to bring together just for the same cause, even if they disagree on certain stuff, people are still coming together. Australia doesn't have that as much. It doesn't have as much camaraderie in the sense of putting stuff aside for the greater good or for the same outcome. Margherita, you were saying that everyone kind of came together for these rallies, this manifestazioni in Italy. How do you think they do it? How do you think they're able to do it compared to here?
Yeah, that's a very good question. It's definitely, there's a very different history from like Italy to Australia. There's, you know, I've only had like a glimpse of Australia living here for just a few years now. I'm sure there's a lot of difficulties in Italy as well when it comes from like building movements and coming together from all like different facets of different organizations. But I think generally like what's really powerful about feminism and these demonstrations, and I'm talking also about like, you know, like the 25th of November, the International Day Against Gender Violence. I feel like these are always the biggest demonstrations in Italy. And there's, I don't know, somehow all these intersectional issues come together under like the feminist lens, and without it it's really impossible to like fight even like colonialism, which is something that I think like Italy also can take on as a perspective like within its country in a very different way than Australia, of course, because we live in the colony here.
But you've also had a history, Italy's also had a history of colonization, and I think it's something that's yet to be taken on board as a mainstream critique.
Oh, that for sure. Yeah. I totally agree. Yeah. We don't get taught of that in school. No. We don't know anything about it. That's certainly something that it needs to be addressed. There's some really interesting writers that are trying to do that right now and try to like narrate that story and make it, I don't know, make people understand that it's something that relates to all of us.
Yes, for sure.
But I wonder whether part of the issue in Australia, and it's on, I think, manifestazioni in general, is that often when people come here, there's an expectation that they leave their politics behind.
Yeah.
Right? So is that a question? Or is it that when people come here, a lot of people who came here as immigrants, and I know with my family and with the people that I've worked with in unions, it is so crucial to establish themselves. Comprare la casa, mandare I bambini a scuola, stabilirsi bene. That they don't, you know, it's almost like they do leave things behind. They cling together, and going out and marching on the streets, how important is it? I don't know. For them.
Well, you know, I think there's a certain comfort in living in Australia that we have to recognize. I feel it, you know, like we're very privileged to live in this country, I think, on many levels. And as a recent Italian migrant, I also feel like a very privileged migrant. And I understand that it's like people need to deal with all these issues. Like me, myself, I need to deal with like paying the rent and it's a struggle. But my impression when I moved here was that it's very easy to like settle in discomfort e quindi non alzarsi e lottare per tutte le questioni politiche che non dovremmo mai dimenticarci. I don't know what the answer to that is, but I think we should definitely keep doing like political formation and not forget to like get up.
I don't agree with the migrant communities being closed in on themselves. I think coming to a colonial settler nation like Australia, there is already a hierarchy of humanity established here.
Absolutely.
With Indigenous people at the bottom, unfortunately, and then a whole range of migrant communities. That keeps changing depending on the needs of what's going on. But if you think that the first ACTU conference for migrant workers was held in 1981 or two, now that's like, you know, a long time after mass migration occurred, and that only occurred because organisations like FILEF and many other left-wing migrant organisations got together and they had their own migrant workers' conferences in the 70s to push the unions to realise that there were new industrial subjects in this country. So that was a long, long battle. And what they were saying is, we want our union to represent us. We want to be able to be part of this union, but the way it's structured, we can't be. So, you know, like we have the worst jobs. We've got all these pressures to survive with all these crummy jobs. No OHS laws before that was until the 80s. And here we are trying to get into our unions and participate in our unions. And so even if you look at the huge strikes of the 70s with Ford, for example, where we had 10 weeks of strike action, that's not an easy thing for people on low wages, where, you know, they had difficulty in getting their union to accept what they were fighting for. So I don't know about migrant workers being closed in on themselves. I think they have been and continue to be marginalised parts of the Australian landscape, sadly. And I think that's what we need to fight against, to say, no, we are here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's something linking back to Italy that I read from USB across the weekend was that, and I think this is, trust my facts for a minute, is that the government has eliminated or are looking to eliminate their equality advisor, which affects stuff in Italy with like positions of female workers, which are already quite low anyway. And so to get rid of this crucial role then affects women workers.
Well, they're following the Americans, aren't they, in getting rid of all those equal opportunity sorts of...
And to not have to not have someone to even keep it in check when there's already like a structural inequality anyway. And then heaps of female workers are already penalised for like postnatal when they take maternity leave. Maybe their jobs aren't getting renewed or their contracts aren't renewed. They have less pay. They get kind of punished for that. But then also having like the traditional element of needing to be a mother or like having that social pressure and to not have to remove a position like that to which doesn't even keep keep males in the workforce, keep work structures in check for making sure that equality, some form of equality is there, is pretty pretty
I just wanted to mention on this topic that actually like just like super recently in February, they tried to pass a law that would equalize like parental leave, making it so that like there would be like 5 months for both the mother and the father at 100% salary. But of course it failed. And currently like the law says that dads are allowed only 10 days of parental leave and mothers only get like between like 30 and 80% of their salary anyway during their maternal leave. So yeah, it is like awful what is happening also at our government level in terms of our rights. Yeah, and workers' rights and mothers' rights and just like people's rights, really human rights.
We've been listening to an excerpt from a recent episode of FILEF, the Italian Migrant Workers and Their Families Organization, where members discuss Italian International Women's Day demonstrations and how they compare to those here. FILEF is presented weekly in Italian and English every Wednesday from 6:30 to 7:30. The full episode can be heard at 3cr.org.au/FILEF.
We are now joined by Lucinda Thorpe, privacy campaigner at Digital Rights Watch. Last week, Lucinda wrote an article called Too Much Information, Dating Apps and AI, which looks into the ways in which these platforms are collecting and monetizing people's personal and biometric data, as well as how AI is being integrated into this technology. Thank you for coming on the show to speak to us about this today, Lucinda.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So, firstly, it was such a sobering read, this article, and I'm sure many listeners are familiar with dating apps, perhaps have used them or are currently using them. To start off with, can you tell us what do dating apps actually record in terms of data, and what is this data used for?
They collect a lot of data. So firstly, there's the data that you knowingly input. So photos, age, birthday, star sign, height, religion, weight, race, family structure, so if you have kids, sexuality, political views, your geolocational data, and your dating parameters, so what you're looking for. Apps also prompt, well, certain apps also prompt users to input sexual experience, kinks, disabilities, drug use, and HIV status. So they're collecting some very sensitive data. Then there's the information that you don't knowingly input, like your typing pattern, your messages, your swipe patterns, when you hesitate. If you link your Facebook or Instagram to your account, it has access to the data from those platforms too, like your likes and your social network. So they're collecting a lot of data. Now, how is that data used? Obviously, some of this data is used to show your profile to people who might be interested in you, but it has other uses too. So a quarter of apps record metadata from your images, like the phone the photo was taken on, the location of the photo, the time it was taken. All of that is analyzed and used to decipher characteristics about yourself, such as your likes and dislikes. 64% of dating apps make inferences based upon your data. For example, are you rock climbing in your photo? Are you at a protest? Are you wearing a MAGA hat? The result is a really enriched data set. And 80% of dating apps will sell your personal information so that this data can end up in the hands of advertisers selling you rock climbing gear or maybe even political ads.
Mm. Wow, that is... Yeah, some pretty shocking stuff. I think we all know that these apps and platforms are collecting our data, but I think sometimes we don't actually understand how deep it goes or how many layers. So, yeah, what you were just describing just now, Lucinda, I think everyone in the studio is pretty shocked by that. You said that, dating apps are monetizing this data to advertisers. Is it just advertisers or, who else can they sell this to?
So unfortunately, dating apps have a pretty bad track record when it comes to sharing this data. Research by the Norwegian Consumer Council found that Google, Facebook and other advertising companies were embedded within the apps and collected all sorts of data on the users. These third parties could then sell that data on to fourth parties. For example, research found that the answers from OkCupid's 419-question survey featuring questions on masturbation, abortion, and drug use were shared with a commercial third party. This is the ad tech industry, where all your cookies are devoured by data-hungry giants who create incredibly detailed consumer profiles of you. And then they auction off the right to place just the right ad in front of you at just the right time for you to click the link. So these incredibly detailed consumer profiles have not just been bought by advertisers, but also by journalists, governments, and even religious organisations seeking to out gay priests.
Yeah, that is quite scary stuff. And just hearing you talk about not just these companies selling it to third parties, but then selling it on again to fourth parties, just goes to show how far your data can travel without your knowledge or consent. I wanted to pivot a bit slightly and talk about safety and privacy. So in your article, you discuss some of the tools used to keep users safe, but they could also expose users to privacy breaches. So I was wondering if you could explain this tension in a bit more detail.
Yes, so face scans are the perfect example of this. When you sign up to a dating app, you need to provide a face scan to prove you're the person in your images. So your face is mapped and measured and your unique face print is collected. It's an important feature. It protects from catfishing and helps people who've been banned from the app not make new accounts and re-enter the app and harass people. So it serves an important purpose. The catch here is that your biometric face data is very sensitive. Unlike a password or a token, you can't reset your face. If a face print is compromised, foreign governments, ex-partners, strangers, and corporations could use it to identify and track an individual. But dating apps offer limited reassurance that this data will be deleted or protected. For example, Hinge states that face maps and face vectors are retained for the lifetime of an account. This means your face print, despite having served its purpose, is being retained as a sitting duck for hackers. Half of dating apps have had a data breach in the past 3 years. So it's really not a good sign for your facial privacy. I mean, the message here is that when privacy isn't prioritized, protective safety features merely swap out one risk with another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point, Lucinda. And I think that's something that we've discussed before when talking about so-called safety measures, whether that's face scans or age verification or other means of, purportedly keeping people safe. Now, I wanted to talk about AI and how this is being integrated into dating apps. Can you talk about, how AI is being introduced into dating platforms and what the concerns are there?
So for a number of apps, AI decides who sees your profile. Bumble recently announced a few days ago they've taken this to the next step, and they are ditching the swipe in favor of an AI matchmaker. My concern here is that these matchmaking AIs have to absorb all of the data of the users. So that massive list I rattled off earlier, that all has to get absorbed. You know, that 419 questionnaire that I mentioned with OkCupid, that would be absorbed as well. So you're putting all of your very sensitive data eggs in one very hackable basket. My second concern is about bias being baked into the AI. So AIs learn from the data that they train. For example, Grindr's wingman is quite sexually charged, probably because it was trained off the 111 billion messages sent on the app. So what happens when AI learns the patterns of who likes who? A study found that white people send likes to other white people 80% of the time, and only 3% of white contact was directed at black people. Black people were 10 times more likely to contact a white person on a dating app than a white person was to contact a black person. If the AI setting you up is training on this, my concern is that users are going to have a segregated dating experience.
And so finally, Lucinda, finding a solution to these problems also seems quite complex. There are concerns around certain privacy reforms, including the right to delete. To finish off our interview today, can you tell us how having something like the right to delete wouldn't be an easy fix?
So the right to delete your data is super important. It's especially valuable for LGBTQ plus dating app users who are concerned about their data outing them. So this is not me trashing the right to delete. It is an awesome idea. But it poses a unique challenge to dating apps because a serial harasser could request the deletion of their data from a dating app, including the evidence of abusive create barriers should a victim of their behaviour pursue legal or police action. Now, any legislation that introduced the right to delete would almost definitely have a provision that allowed platforms to retain data when it was evidentiary or deletion posed a risk to safety. Mm. But this requires dating apps to proactively identify and retain this data. And based on their current data practices, I'm not sure I would trust dating apps to actually do this well. Mm. So it's really important that they step up and improve their data practices, because when the right to delete comes in, they're going to play an even more important role in protecting women online. Mm.
Well, thank you so much, Lucinda, for joining us on the program today to talk to us in more detail about dating apps and about their exploitation of people's data, as well as the use of AI into these platforms. I think there's a lot for people to consider here and learn more about. And so we're really grateful that you could join us again to, give us a better insight into what's happening there.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been speaking to Lucinda Thorpe, privacy campaigner at Digital Rights Watch, who was speaking to us about how we can maintain privacy while using dating apps. To read her article, you can head to digitalrightswatch.org.au/articles. We're going to play a song now. This is by Georgia Mack, who is currently working and living in the US, but is coming back to so-called Australia for a national tour. I believe that in Nam, Melbourne, her Thursday and Friday shows are sold out, but there are, I think, tickets still available for Tuesday. So that's next Tuesday at the Tote. There will also be Rin McArdle supporting her, who I know we've had on the show before. So here is Georgia Mack's song Pay Per View from her 2025 EP God's Favourite.
I've got one friend, we both want the same thing. Go out at night and come back in the morning. The walk of pride when I get inside. I can't say where I've been. I'm gonna find love again. I've got one phone, it's blowing up in my hand, asking for asking me how I am. Out is fine, and I don't mind. Where you are is where I've been. I'm gonna find love again. So I keep waiting on God's favorite pay-per-view to watch. Oh,
what?
determined to lose it. It got broke bad, and now I've got no use for it. I'm just depressed, me and all the rest. It's just me and my friend. Gonna find love again. I'm gonna find love again.
Next up, we are going to be playing an interview with myself and Freya Leonard. Freya Leonard is a climate campaigner for the Australian Conservation Foundation. Here is an interview that we had discussing the recent federal budget release, specifically discussing the impact of the lack of tax on gas.
Thanks for coming onto the show today, Freya.
Thanks for having me, Julia.
No worries. So could you tell me about...
Kick off with the failure of the federal government to lean into what can only be described as a spectacularly popular policy in imposing a 25% tax on gas exports. I'm astonished that the Albanese government has failed to step up to the plate on this one, and made worse by the fact that he announced that he would not be backing the gas export tax at an industry luncheon was a real slap in the face to Australia, to the climate, and to our budget. So really disappointed to see that the federal government is consigning themselves essentially to a political wilderness in refusing to lean into a policy that was very straightforward, would have gleaned $17 billion in income for public coffers, and would have finally meant that the gas industry was paying something close to their fair share for the enormous damage that they've been doing to our oceans and to our farmland. And you know, I think that the federal government is trying to play this as being a favour to our export partners. You know, so we export gas regionally, Japan, China, Indonesia, Taiwan, Korea, and but we know that Japan has been on selling our gas and themselves imposing a tax on our gas, which they're getting at an incredibly low rate, and then they're selling on to other export partners. So there's so much that's wrong about this. There's no way we can even justify it as being, you know, responsible export traders with other countries in the region, because they are themselves on selling our gas and putting the money in their pockets. And you know, it's not ameliorated by the measures that they have introduced to support climate and nature protection in this budget. You know, they're continuing the incredibly popular cheaper home batteries program to the tune of $7.2 billion over the forward estimates. And maybe that will be enough to curry favour with the voting public. But it's such a small capitulation to what has been an incredibly effective program. And when I say incredibly effective, you know, Australia has had a steady rise over the last 25, 26 years in renewable energy take up. So we've seen, you know, between say 2000 to 2023-24 financial year, we've gone from having 20,000 gigawatt hours produced renewably up to, up to about 90,000 in 2023-24. And currently that's sitting at around 47%. So I think it's fair to say that the Australian public has been leaning into, and a lot of that's, you know, rooftop solar. So the Australian public has been doing a lot of the heavy lifting to decarbonise Australia's energy economy.
And yes. It's definitely that divide between, what the government's deciding and how the people feel towards these issues. I think a lot of people are really concerned about climate change and want to make that difference. And I was reading somewhere, I think you've mentioned maybe another interview, that Australia doesn't measure its methane emissions. Why?
Not accurately. No, not accurately.
Yeah, okay.
So but we can tell the extent to which Australia isn't accurately recording our own methane emissions, because there are satellites that fly over Australia and record the methane that comes off this particular landmass. And the disparity between what is recorded in the NGERS sort of national carbon accounting and what the methane detection satellites are picking up is vast. And that's due in part to very sloppy standards of methane reporting from coal mines nationally, as well as fugitive emissions. So those are the accidental emissions from gas and coal projects, both onshore and offshore.
Mm-hmm.
But also, and most crushingly, the abandoned mines that we have littering the country are not required to report their methane emissions.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this, you know, we Australia signed up in 2023, Australia signed up to the Global Methane Pledge. And since then, we've done pretty much nothing to implement policy that will reduce our methane emissions. We pledged to reduce our methane emissions by 30% on 1919 levels by 2030, and we've done very little to get ourselves there. But the truth is that the 1990 levels that we are indexing against aren't even accurately recorded. So if we were to go back and look at how much methane we were actually producing in 1990, we would find that it's a much higher level, and we would have to do a lot more to implement that 30% reduction. So, I mean, all of it is nonsense built on nonsense. It's incredibly disappointing because we're seeing now around, you know, the continent, we're seeing an increase in 1 in 100 year climate events and catastrophic climate events, whether they're bushfires or cyclones or floods. And the easiest, fastest way for us to make deep cuts to our own carbon equivalent emissions and greenhouse gas emissions is methane. Methane is the most potent climate pollutant that we are emitting in Australia and that we have globally. It's 84 times more polluting to the climate over a 20-year period than carbon dioxide. So the easiest way for us to wind back our climate impact is to immediately jump on methane and to reduce the amount of methane that we're putting out into the atmosphere. And we're both failing to monitor how much methane we're producing, and certainly we're nowhere near taking the sorts of steps that we need to be implementing to reduce our carbon emissions. And I want to make it clear, it's not just the gas industry, it's also the coal industry. It's a little recognised fact in Australia that most of our methane emissions actually come from coal.
Wow. Yeah, I think that's really important for us to be aware of, and kind of, yeah, know as consumers and remain aware of what's happening with this methane release, and the fact that, yeah, the numbers aren't necessarily telling the truth. I hope there's some more investigation surrounding that eventually.
Indeed, and meanwhile, the government continues to greenlight coal and gas projects, whether governments really, it's, you know, state and federal governments and territory, the Northern Territory, are continuing to greenlight coal and gas projects. We've seen an approval for the really heavily methane polluting Hale Creek coal mine in Queensland. We're at the moment anticipating that the Hunter Valley Operation coal mine in New South Wales is it's on the table for approval, and there's a, you know, chance that it will be approved. And the Victorian and federal government jointly have announced further gas drilling in the Otway Basin. You know, the Otway community has stood very, very strongly against any further gas expansions in their waters, and it's a whale migration pathway. Short-finned eels, so endangered species like short-finned eels, and certainly penguins are reliant on that area, and yet we're still prepared to allow gas drilling in, you know, those sections of the Southern Ocean. And then at the moment, the federal government has opened for consultation. They're calling for expressions of interest for acreage release, that is, for more seismic blasting, which is, you know, releasing a Hiroshima bomb's worth of noise every 4 to 10 seconds in the hunt for new gas and oil in the Southern Ocean between Victoria and Tasmania. So at a time when the federal government really must be developing an exit strategy for fossil fuels extraction nationally. They're actually continuing to hold the door open for further projects. It's completely beyond belief. We are at such a critical time in the Earth's climate history, and Australia, as the 11th largest producer of greenhouse gases, really has an important leadership role to play. We have endless access to solar resources. We are in such a strong position to adopt 100% renewables and to show that sort of leadership to our regional partners and to show the world that it's possible. And we're just failing to step up to it, and we're continuing to bow down to the fossil fuel industries. It's embarrassing beyond measure, but more than that, it's enormously dangerous, not just for us living today, but for the generations of every species that comes after us.
I think it's this thing of not being able to see what's happening. Like, you know, only every day we don't know that things like seismic blasting is happening until we do the research and find out more and find out what the government is doing.
We've been listening to a conversation with Freya Leonard, who is a climate campaigner with the Australian Conservation Foundation. To take action, Freya encourages us to contact our local MPs in protest against Australia's carbon emission usage. You can find out more from the Australian Conservation Foundation at acf.org.au.
Up next, we have a song for you. This is by Saloma. Saloma was a Singaporean-Malaysian singer, actress, fashion icon, overall legendary queen who rose to fame in the 1950s. This is Bila Larut Malam, or When the Night Falls.
Bila Larut Malam.
That was Bila Larut Malam, or When Night Falls by Saloma.
Next up, we are going to be hearing an excerpt from a conversation that Tuesday's Home Time Jan Bartlett had with the humanitarian photojournalist Liz O'Taylor. In an interview that first aired on the 12th of May 2026, Liz related her experiences during a two-week visit to the Western Sahara refugee camp in Algeria. November 2025 has marked 50 years of Moroccan occupation of Western Sahara, and 5 decades that Sahrawi have lived in exile in refugee camps in southwest Algeria. Here is Jan.
The occupation by Morocco, where did you get your information from?
I've delved in this area for a while, and I've been working on a book which is focusing primarily on troubled borders. So they're borders that have been created and drawn up by colonial powers throughout the years. And the book also looks into the continued impacts of colonialism on these lands, even though the flags have exited the lands. So Western Sahara came up as part of my research.
Was it difficult to get into the camp? Did you have to get permission from the Algerian officials, or was it it's an autonomous camps?
I did have to get permission from Algeria, and I had to enter as a journalist, which I don't often do. I just find entering as a journalist limits my ability to properly understand an area. I had to because it wasn't, the camps are not an area that tourists would venture into. It is not something that you would go to for a holiday. So for example, you know, when I've been back and I've talked about where I've been, and friends as well as associates alike, they know what I do. So when I said, I've just come back from Western Sahara, and they would say, oh, you've gone on a holiday for once. I said, no, actually. And she's like, you haven't gone to Morocco? I'm like, no, I have not gone to Morocco. That is the misconception that most people have about Western Sahara. There's very little understanding that Western Sahara is actually occupied by Morocco, and there's very little understanding of the historical context of the Sahrawi struggle. And I only realized that when I was back and I would talk to friends, and they go, you've just gone to Morocco. I'm like, no.
I'd imagine you've been in refugee camps before. What yes. were you expecting?
I have been to many refugee camps, including the Palestinian camps in Lebanon. I've been to favelas in Brazil. I've been to many conflict zones. And I haven't really been to anything like this. So when I arrived in Tindouf, it was close to midnight, because all the flights out of Algiers left at an odd hour. And so I was actually there close to midnight. And as such, I was basically driven to the camps, and I had no real idea of what the camps really looked like, other than the fact that it was raining cats and dogs, which is something that does not happen in the Hamada Desert, which is the Algerian side where the Sahrawis have been exiled to. I remembered in the morning when I woke, and usually, you know, even in the worst of places, you would wake to birds chirping, children playing, noises. Here I woke to just sand and rocks being pelted against the mud house that I was being hosted in. I remembered there was no sounds of birds. There was no real calls of rooster, which is often what you hear in the mornings. Mind you, it was Ramadan. So I sort of attributed that silence, that stillness to Ramadan. But even after that was over, it was still the same thing. Stillness, I think that's the word. It's just a sense of silence and stillness where that is not explained by peace. that is explained by something that is held in suspension almost. That was my entire observation. I was there for over 2 weeks and I just could not get my head around that stillness.
And that's suspension because the people are still waiting after 50 years.
Exactly, Jen. You know, 50 years that the United Nations has been working towards decolonization. And that itself says a lot. You know, when a decolonization process to return the land of a people has taken 50 years, five decades, how many generations now? Probably three generations are born in camp. I think that itself says a lot about the diplomatic process or lack thereof.
I'd imagine you would have had an interpreter, but were people willing and able to tell you about their lives and hopefully that you'd take those messages back home with you?
Absolutely. The one thing that I do that is different to a usual journalist or a reporter who rocks up, you know, for an hour or two and they try to capture everything they can within that time is I spend time with people, because to me that is how you actually go about understanding their lives or an attempt to understand their daily lives. And people welcomed me into their homes. You know, I must have had hundreds of cups of teas from home to home. I don't know if you know anything about the tea ceremony.
Yes, I do.
Yes, and I remember arriving in Smara camp, and that was past midnight, and the first cup of tea was served, and, you know, they explained to me that the first cup is a bit bitter. It's bitter like life. I had my first cup, and it was already extremely sweet. Then came the second cup, maybe about a half an hour later. That was, I think it's sweet like love, and that was sweeter again. And this could go on for a good hour and a half, if not more. And the third cup came, and that was gentle like life, and that was the sweetest of the three cups. And that night, I remember just buzzing, not being able to sleep at all, just buzzing with sugar and caffeine. But to answer your question, the Sahrawis welcomed me into their homes. They openly told me their stories. I met with veterans. I met with the wives of veterans who held the fort, who basically created the society within the Hamada, which is the Algerian side, when they were exiled. When the men went to fight, the women basically created absolutely everything that we're seeing today in the camps, as well as having to, you know, look after the children and create schools and as well as law and order, etc. So I met with, you know, the wives of the veterans. I met with the generation that was exiled. I met with the generation who was born in camps. I chatted and played with children, and they were all really open in sharing their stories. Why? Because as with, I guess, colonialism across the board, propaganda is rife. There's a lot of narratives floating around on the internet, on socials, in chatters, that basically paints a story that is not real. And so to the people, for them to share their stories with someone who cared enough to be there with them, especially when no journalists have taken any interest for the past years, where the Sahrawi voices have been deliberately silenced, they took every opportunity to meet with me so that I can tell their story.
The tea ceremonies is part of retaining their culture.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And even though they've been exiled for 50 years, the culture is very much a part of their identity, and it's something that they're very conscious of actually retaining and keeping. Even through the stillness, you know, the tea ceremony does not stop. The cups of teas don't stop. And what happens during these cups of teas is chats about life, about the past, about the future, about politics, about someone having a baby, about schools, about exchanges to Spain, about everything, about life, something that we don't really do anymore. So through those three cups of tea, from one household to another, they're actually engaging deeply with each other. And this includes the children too. Children aren't on devices well, some of them are, but they aren't on devices like our children are. The children are very much a part of the struggle. They're very much a part of this temporary state that marks their life at present.
Are the men part of that ceremony?
Absolutely, absolutely. It's actually a really open and progressive society. So, you know, we would think that 50 years in exile, in the desert, in the middle of nowhere, that people are uneducated or ignorant. They are not. They're actually quite the opposite of that. The Sahrawi culture, the Sahrawi society prides themselves on education, men and women. And being a Muslim society, again, you know, where there has been a lot of, I guess, narratives or propaganda against Islam, it is a society that prides itself on ensuring that both men and women are educated enough that when home is available again, when they are able to return home to their lands in Western Sahara, that they basically are able to run a society like any other society is being run, but effectively and efficiently. So they said to me, you know, like I met with the president of the Sahrawi Red Crescent, and he said to me that once we are ready, we will basically uproot from here, we will settle back on our lands, and we have doctors, dentists, engineers, everything, teachers, everything we need to basically start our own society.
We've been listening to an excerpt from last week's episode of Tuesday Hometime with Jan Bartlett. To listen to the full conversation with Liz Lowe Taylor, go to 3cr.org.au/hometime-tuesday. Tuesday. Tuesday Hometime broadcasts local, national and international interviews with activists on human rights, civil liberties and animal welfare issues. The show has been on air since the late 1980s. Tune in to 3CR on Tuesdays from 4 to 6 p.m. to hear more.
We know you love listening to 3CR. But we also know that many of you haven't downloaded the Community Radio Plus app yet.
The app lets you tune in anywhere and share the station with your friends.
So, show the love and share the love and search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
Joining us now to speak about the upcoming Hearts for Burma fundraiser at Bar Flippies this Friday is Victoria. Victoria is an Australian-born Thai Burmese lawyer and event organizer behind the Hearts for Burma fundraiser. Passionate about human rights in Myanmar and beyond, she aims to raise awareness of the ongoing challenges facing Myanmar while also celebrating its rich culture and resilience. Welcome, Victoria. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yeah.
I appreciate some time to speak to me.
Of course, thanks so much for making time and waking up in the morning to have a chat. But yeah, I guess to start us with, I was just talking to one of my colleagues yesterday because she was asking me what am I going to be up to this morning, and I said I was interviewing you and I'm going to be chatting about Burma. And this is, you know, I work in a university setting, and so this is an educated person. And she was like, oh, what's happening in Burma? So, and this is, I'm sure you're very familiar with this. So to, I guess, yes. Start us off, what is happening in Burma, Victoria? Maybe, you know, starting from 2021 till present day.
Yeah, no, it's such a good question. I think, unfortunately, it's not really known by many people. But in broad strokes, I guess, in 2021, on the 1st of February, the military staged a coup and overthrew the democratically elected National League for Democracy government. And ever since the coup, Myanmar has been facing one of the most overlooked humanitarian crises in the world. According to some UN sources, the suffering of people in Myanmar has also actually gotten worse in recent years. Currently, there's millions of Burmese people that are displaced internally and across borders. And many live in temporary camps with very limited access to food, medicine, education or safety. The Minnesota government has also continuously unlawfully attacked civilians by way of airstrikes, massacres and mass arrests. There was a really devastating earthquake that happened in March last year, and even then the military government continued to carry out their aerial attacks. For example, in 2025, the airstrikes increased by more than 50% compared to the year before.
Wow. Okay.
And yeah, this actually made last year the deadliest year for civilians since the coup. Their airstrikes, they kill, they injure or displace Burmese civilians in almost every state and region in Burma, and villages have been burned down, and the airstrikes have hit schools, hospitals, religious buildings and more.
Yeah.
On top of that, the military government also introduced mandatory military conscription laws, which has also meant that a lot of young Burmese people are forced to fight against their own people.
Wow.
And this has contributed to many young people fleeing from their homes to avoid the recruitment as an opportunity to be exempt from military service.
Wow.
There's
okay.
laws restricting media on the ground. And in areas of armed conflict, there's hunger has increased and the price of food staples has increased. In January this year, nearly a quarter of Myanmar's population faces high levels of acute food insecurity, and more than a third are in urgent need of humanitarian assistance. Foreign aid's also often obstructed, and since last year there's been foreign aid cuts, which has impacted health, education, humanitarian aid. And on top of all that, there was an election imposed by the military in December last year to January this year.
Yeah.
This was a military-controlled ballot, and it was only held in select townships, largely confined to urban areas under military control. It was a tightly controlled process, and conflict-affected regions were excluded, as well as displaced populations and minorities, including the Rohingya.
Yeah.
And parties opposing the military rule, like including the National League for Democracy party, were banned from participating.
Of course.
This election period was also a time where there was intense violence. For example, open sources have documented 408 attacks, which killed at least 170 civilians during the election period alone. So that's just some of the things that are happening, and have happened for a very, very long time.
Yeah, yeah. And it's thank you so very much, Victoria, for sharing that. I think, even for me, and I have some Burmese friends, and even I feel like I don't think we ever really truly have grappled with the scope of that. I think partly due to obviously the poly crisis that we are facing, but I think that's unfair, and because I read somewhere that Burma is actually the third most intense conflict in the world right now, and yet outside of that region the crisis barely registers, right? Especially in places like Europe and of course in Australia as well, where there is in fact a sizable Burmese community. Why do you think this is the case, and I guess what is the impact of this lack of awareness?
Yeah, so it's a really good point. I think there's a couple of reasons. Firstly, there's, like I mentioned, I think restricted media access on the ground, so it's difficult and dangerous for foreign journalists to report on the ground. So in consequence, there's minimal on-the-ground reporting of footage. The reporters can face arrest, and there's limited access to conflict zones.
Okay.
So I also think that the situation in Burma has been going on for a very long time, and it's also really complex.
Yeah.
So I think that's meant that Myanmar has become an ongoing background crisis. I also think that Myanmar's politically distant from Europe and Australia and other Western audiences.
Yeah.
It's seen as like an internal conflict, and it doesn't directly involve the West. So unfortunately, I think when the West isn't involved, it's not really prioritized by Western media, and the lack of interest of what's happening.
Yeah.
And a lack of coverage by Western media means that people don't even know what's going on.
Exactly.
Because they can't take an interest. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess, and which then makes the event you're holding this Friday all the more important. You know, this Hearts for Burma fundraiser, which I understand. Is this the second year running? Am I right to say that?
Yes.
Beautiful. Yes, can you please tell us more about this fundraiser and how did you come up with this? What it's like to be organizing it for the second year in a row?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Hearts for Burma fundraiser actually started as a response to the really devastating earthquake that struck Myanmar last year.
Yeah.
At the time, I felt very helpless and upset by the lack of media attention surrounding that. And so a close friend of mine suggested that we start a fundraiser, if you don't know. Since then, the fundraiser has grown into this incredible community effort. Not only have we been able to raise funds for Burmese communities subject to the severe humanitarian crisis, but we've also been able to raise awareness of the issues of what's happening and what's going on there. And I think as the situation in Myanmar worsens, raising awareness is something that we'll really prioritise with the Hearts for Burma fundraiser.
Yeah.
It's also really important to work with local organisations on the ground to make sure the funds are distributed appropriately. And as we have close ties to people helping on the ground, it's really comforting to know that with this fundraiser that we've organised, that the funds are directly going to those in need.
Beautiful.
So I think alongside awareness, Hearts for Burma fundraiser is a celebration and opportunity to share Myanmar's rich culture, which I think, still remains relatively unknown to many people. And it's also an incredible opportunity for me personally to showcase the talent of many friends and family. Everyone that's really involved in the fundraiser has volunteered to help out. It's a lot of my friends, a lot of my family, a lot of people from the Burmese community and the wider local community who just really want to show some care support for this cause, which is really beautiful. A lot of hard work is put into it, but it's really exciting being able to kind of spread awareness, raise funds for a really important cause that's really close to my heart, and also have people that I really love kind of being involved and show what community can do. I think it's really, really powerful.
Oh, 100%,
such a beautiful community.
And that's so important for, like, especially, I understand as someone who's also, you know, in the diaspora, like the diaspora community, for us to come together in moments like this, because we can feel so far away from, you know, our loved ones back home when something like this happens. And so being able to come together with people who understand without you saying anything, you know, how you're feeling, I think that's also a beautiful experience in and of itself. Unfortunately, we have to wrap up, but I understand there is a raffle prize to be won. And could you tell us more about the raffle? What kind of prizes? Some of the artists that you've been working with?
Yeah, so there are 14 incredible prizes to be won.
Amazing.
Raffle tickets, $5 each. It's open now. You can see it in my Instagram bio at 05Z22M or the moran-project.com. But the prizes are all local artists. There's a Burmese Spotlight Prize, which includes a Burmese bag by Burmese brand Win Boutique and an 18 print by Burmese Australian artist Shan Primrose, also based in Nam. There's workshops, for example, a 101 DJ lesson with local artists Shima and Kuya Neil. There's a bag made by Clingy Bag, which is a slow fashion accessories brand based in Nam, a gift voucher for Alchemy Orange, which is a botanical design studio based in Nam by Yorta Yorta woman Sean Stewart. There's a leather bag designed by my brother, a book display stand, which is a furniture piece by Fenice Furniture. There's a lot to be won. And oh my God. They're all really amazing. I'm very proud of the work.
That sounds incredible. Yeah, I need a bookshelf. So, yeah, I'm going to be there. My friend told me that they're making tea. They're serving tea at the event. So I am definitely going to be there. $5 is an absolute steal for all the stuff you've just listed for us. So that's incredible. Thank you so much for joining us today, Victoria. I look forward to seeing you this Friday. And thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. Thanks for taking an interest in what's happening in Myanmar.
Of course, absolutely. Thank you. We've been listening to Victoria, a Thai Burmese lawyer and event organizer behind the Hearts for Burma fundraiser that will be happening this Friday at Bar Flippies. If you want more information, we will be putting it in the show notes. But if you just type Hearts for Burma fundraiser in whatever platform you use to do internet searches these days, it should come up on an Instagram post. Up next, we have some events, I believe, Julia.
Yes, so the events for this week. So on Tuesday, the 19th of May at 7 to 8 p.m., the Anti-Poverty Centre is hosting an online event called The Most Important Broken Promises Post-Budget Briefing at the Anti-Poverty... you can find out more on Instagram at PovertyCent for more details. And you can also listen back to Kristen from Anti-Poverty Centre on Thursday Breakfast from last week. On the 20th of May at 6:30 p.m., there will be a national webinar organised by the Australian Anti-AUKUS Coalition and supported by IPAN, The Dangerous World of AUKUS and US Military Occupation, Confronting Laws Restricting / Suppressing Protest Speech and Action. And you can find out more information at antiukuscoalition.org for more details. You could also listen back to Shirley from No AUKUS Vic on Thursday Breakfast from last week. And we'll also add any notes in our podcast as well.
And that's our show today. So we started this morning at 7:15 a.m. with a replay from Radio Feel Left, International Women's Day episode, featuring a roundtable discussion between Hannah, Margarita, Renata and Lorella, who are members of Feel Left, the Italian Migrant Workers and the Families Organization. At 7:30, we were joined by Lucinda Thorpe, privacy campaigner at Digital Rights Watch, sharing about an article she wrote called Too Much Information, Dating Apps and AI, looking at how AI is being integrated into this technology.
At 7:45, we had an interview with Freya Leonard, who is the climate campaigner for ACF, who spoke to us about the federal budget release and has an expertise in energy and gas.
At 8 o'clock, we listened to an excerpt from a conversation from Tuesday Home Times' Jen Bartlett with humanitarian photojournalist Liz Lowe Taylor about the Sahrawis who have lived in exile in refugee camps in southwest Algeria. And finally, at 8:15, we were joined by Victoria speaking about the upcoming Hearts for Burma fundraiser that will be taking place this Friday at Bar Flippies. Tickets is a $5 raffle. The prizes are amazing. I really, really hope everybody show up and show support for our Burmese friends in the diaspora. But yeah, jam-packed show today. Yeah. And I hope everyone's going to have a great morning ahead. Up next, we do have Accent of Women. So please do stay tuned for that and see you next week.
Thank you. Bye.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.